Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you have come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Andrew Rome, and I'm today's worship leader. I am joined by co-leader Amanda Rome. Lay-led services are a time-honored Unitarian Universalist tradition. We believe that the Sunday service is best reflected in a variety of voices and experiences. We're glad to have you with us this morning. We hope you find something in the service today that nourishes your spirit and helps you find and keep your balance.
Heart is a symbol of our liberal faith, a faith built on the foundation of freedom, reason, and tolerance, a faith sustained by acts of kindness and justice, a faith that visions a world flourishing with equality for all her people, a faith that demands the living out of goodness, a faith that requires thoughtfulness, a faith of wholeness. This tiny flame in our hearts is the symbol of the spark of all that is within each of us.
I tried to answer a question from my five-year-old, but instead just confused myself as I stumbled on my explanation. What is the difference between our wants and our needs? Well, sure, we all need food and water and shelter to keep our bodies functioning, but what about our basic human drives for love and understanding? Is a need something for sustaining just our bodies, or do I include spiritual and social needs? So I reasoned to Ray Lynn, determining a need is, or determining what a need is, depends on how we define ourselves. Are we defined by our choices or the parts of ourselves that we don't get to choose? Are we defined by our circumstances or something else entirely? I gave Raylan no clear answer. And I continued to wonder about this. Separating needs and wants for me was like determining the essential and non-essential parts of a person. So what did this mean in terms of my relationships with others? I try to understand others on their own terms, as they want to be understood, and always to see their inherent worth and dignity. But where do I look? What is the source of our inherent worth and dignity in every person? Our service today will consist of a series of perspectives from individuals in the congregation who have had experience with the difficulty of being understood in various contexts. The idea for the service came from our Committee on Ministry, which meets to monitor and support the well-being of our congregation. When reading the book, How to Say It When You Don't Know What to Say, by Robbie Miller Kaplan, they reflected on our many common experiences of being in conversation with someone experiencing a difficult situation, and instead of saying something loving and empathetic, something embarrassingly awkward comes out. Conversely, we all experience challenges and have been told something inappropriate from someone with the very best intentions. Rarely do we have the time and attention at the right moment to listen fully or to find the right words to explain what we're experiencing. Feeling like we lack the right words can prevent us from even engaging on difficult subjects for fear of saying the wrong thing or saying something inappropriate. While our intentions may be caring, we can end up isolating the people who need our community the most. As we listen to different perspectives today, you may find the details differ from your own situation, or you might find your own experiences echoed in their words. Our work to understand the perspective of someone else is universal. Come, let us worship together.
Good morning, everyone. It's very strange to be up here without my violin, but we'll make it work somehow. 1 in 68. I'll say it again. 1 in 68. That is the number of children in the United States who have been diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder, which, according to a recent report by the CDC, is a 30% increase from the 1 in 88 reported just 2 years ago. Autism spectrum disorders, or ASDs, occur in all racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic groups. And there are almost five times more common among our boys, the current number is 1 in 42, by the way, than among girls. That current number is 1 in 189. While these statistics are certainly cause for alarm and further discussion, they are not the reason I stand before you today. As the parent of a teenager with high-functioning autism, I wish to discuss communication. Specifically, communication with someone who communicates differently from us. Our son was diagnosed with something called PDD-NOS shortly after his third birthday. This means that he met some, but not all, of the characteristics for an autism diagnosis. While he lost some words, he never completely lost language. And then a few months later, to add to the mix, he began having partial complex seizures, as many as 18 in one day, which has left him with a slower than normal language processing speed. While his speed has certainly improved thanks to an amazing near photographic memory and years, and I do mean years, of speech therapy and tutoring, his conversation is still not typical. Why is this important? Well, Jonathan, in case you haven't noticed, really, really likes people, and he wants to communicate with everyone he meets. He doesn't always know the correct way to start or end a conversation, and sometimes the people he is trying to communicate with get a little impatient or uncomfortable. I understand this, believe me. It gets more challenging when he thinks details that aren't important or critical to the conversation, such as telling someone what seems like maybe the 100th time, where they live, who they live with, and asking whether or not they were at the Fallow Time Orchestra rehearsal with me. Add an early morning church service and a need for strong coffee to the mix, and it's really easy to become impatient. I get that. However, the only way Jonathan's communication will continue to improve, and thankfully the improvements are continuing, is for everyone to help him. And it's a really easy thing to do, and it won't demand much of anyone. First, when he asks you a question, such as the question he asked this morning as we were coming in, does Deb have a new car? answer it, or say, I don't know, whatever you think is appropriate. Then, before he gets to ask something else that may confuse you, ask him a question, such as, what did you do last week? Or, how was your weekend? Next, and this is really critical, wait. Look him in the eyes, smile at him, and just wait. Usually, an answer will come. Sometimes he may say, I need help, or I'm not sure. And that's okay. He doesn't say it that often anymore, but he still might. So give him some help. Maybe narrow the question. So instead of, what did you do last weekend, ask him, what did you do yesterday or last night? Most likely, he'll tell you we went shopping at the Mustard Seed, or he might tell you about our family game nights. If he does, ask him what games he played and who won. If he switches topics, just ask your question again. It will come. It doesn't need to be much at first, maybe two or three conversational turns, but that's an opportunity for him to practice the skills that he's learning. And I can't think of a better place for him to practice than here in this congregation. After all, we are the church of the open mind. We are the church of the helping hands. We are the church of the loving heart.
Hello. Hi, my name is Anne Lapidus. I'm here today to share my perspective as a woman. Just kidding. But wouldn't that have been nice? Well, people want to talk about my blindness. People want to acknowledge that first, if they acknowledge me at all. It's funny that when you can't see people, suddenly, they can't see you. I find it hard to belong in a large group. A lot of times I just feel like I don't fit in. To give you an understanding, I'm going to give you a scenario of a situation that's been particularly hard for me. I think that maybe some of you relate to this in some level, is that I just don't really feel like I fit in the church that I'm currently attending. So here's what a coffee hour might look like for me. A man approaches. Are you looking at my cookie? Do you want my cookie? I would answer him. But he's obviously talking to the dog and not me. I'm not looking at his cookie. And so it feels like I'm eavesdropping. I don't know what to say in that situation, and so I usually don't say anything. A woman approaches. Would you like some coffee? Yes, that would be fabulous. Thank you so much. She says, I'll be right back. I appreciate her generosity. It would be really nice if we could go together, maybe have a conversation, but I'm fine with that. I have much gratitude. So she comes back, hands me the coffee. I thank her again and take a sip. What a lovely sermon that was today. I really enjoyed the man next to me who's talking to his friends turns. Oh, she's gone. She walked away. And he turns back to his group of friends and keeps on talking. For the most part, I'm standing alone. There's people all around me talking, but I'm by myself. Maybe 6, 7, 8 times, I'll say, thank you, as a person walks past, says, beautiful dog, and keeps on walking. I want people to treat me like a whole person. I want people to ask me about what I thought about the sermon. I could tell them that it reminded me of something that I'm doing, a project I'm doing that maybe you would like to be a part of as well. I could tell you that the hymn today reminded me of a story from my childhood. I want to share with my community. People define me as a blind person, but I'm so much more than that. The biggest limitation that I have, it's not my eyesight. It's the limitations that other people put upon me. It's assumptions that they make about me. I'm a smart, funny, talented woman. I can have good conversations. There's so much more to me. And I'm quite charming, if I do say so myself. So, the next time you have the opportunity to talk to a blind person, please remember, eyesight is not a requirement for friendship, to empathize, to laugh, to love, and to share with one another. Thanks.
Good morning. Hope everyone is well today. I'm going to be talking to you a little bit about addiction, particularly alcoholism. It's a topic that I am familiar with. And in fact, I wrote a very long and involved statement last night and went through it again this morning and made it even better and left it at home. So I'm going to try to reconstruct that brilliant statement. I am a recovering alcoholic, and I'm also an adult child of an alcoholic. I grew up in an alcoholic family, an Irish Catholic drinking family. My grandfather was a typical drunk. kept losing jobs, kept being found in various parts of the city, passed out. He lived with us. My mother is also an alcoholic, but she was totally unpredictable. You never knew when she would get drunk. When alcohol was available, and somehow she got it, I don't know how she got it, but when she started drinking, she would drink until there was nothing left, and that could go on for days or weeks. With the family, there is a denial. My father did not acknowledge the fact that there was a problem. He was in denial about my mother's alcoholism until the day he died, 40 years after she did. There was secrecy in that family. We didn't share anything. We couldn't talk to anyone else about what was going on in that household. So I learned to be quiet, not to communicate. Definitely don't share my emotions. Definitely do not share anything that's important to me with anyone else within the family and also outside the family. So I became isolated and withdrawn and focusing in on my own fantasies and my own head. Really had trouble throughout my life since then communicating. It's not something I feel comfortable with. It's something that I had to learn much later. I didn't drink for a long time. I definitely didn't want to be an alcoholic, but I became an alcoholic. I did start drinking, and I drank for about 15 years on a daily basis, and I recreated my youth. I was married at the time, I had a child, and I also became totally isolated from them. I did not communicate, I did not share anything about what was going on. I functioned pretty well, I got to work, sometimes hungover, but usually I was in decent shape so I could get through work. And I came home and I started drinking, and that was it. Goodbye family, goodbye son. My son wanted to go somewhere, I either didn't want to do it, couldn't do it. I didn't want to drive him to wherever he had to go half drunk. I was somewhat sensible about it. But again, I didn't connect. I had no skills at communicating. And the family, of course, was in denial about the whole thing. My wife said nothing to me. Not the whole time. She said nothing about my drinking. My son didn't say anything either until later, until I got into recovery, and he told me all about it. He was quite open and quite honest, which was good. It's better if it's recognized, to acknowledge it. Things have changed somewhat. You know, when I was growing up, people didn't talk about alcoholism. But today, you know, we hear a lot about it. We hear a lot about recovery centers and people going off to recovery centers. We watch on TV interventions taking place. So we have a better sense of alcoholism and how to deal with alcoholism and how to deal with someone who is alcoholic. Eventually, I did get sober. I've been sober for a while now. And I had to learn how to communicate. I had to learn how to share my feelings with others, how to reach out to others on a very real basis. I can lecture. I can talk about African art quite well. If you want to hear a lecture, I'll give you one right now. But I really can't share what I'm feeling. I can't share, or I have trouble sharing, you know, my feelings and my emotions. And it took getting into recovery, getting into AA, for me to develop some skills in that direction. And it's important, you know, for me to realize that it is necessary for me to be fully aware of my addiction and to try to be honest about it and also to continue developing skills at communicating with people. Because if I shut down, if I keep all this stuff inside, you know, it's not going to be good. It's either going to lead to some kind of weird breakdown or am I going back to alcohol again? And so for me, it's important to be open and honest about it. I do go to AA meetings. I help people there. They help me there. I've learned now the importance of communicating with others and the fact that I am not alone and I need help and we all need help. So thank you.
Growing up in England in the 50s, I never heard the word cancer mentioned. When I did hear of it, it seemed a subject of dread and shame. Then life got busy, and I really hardly ever thought of it. I went to school, got married, started a career, relocated to the United States, followed my husband with several moves, and finally ended up in Kent. I knew people of all ages got cancer, but like death, it seemed to be something that happened to other people. One year in my 40s, I skipped an annual mammogram, and at the next one, was shocked to be called back for more films. Soon I was seeing a surgeon and being reassured that most lumps are benign. The next day I learned it was malignant and that I would be scheduled for surgery in a couple of weeks. I felt I had left the world of the well and entered the world of the sick. I felt frightened and separate. At other appointments, I was faced with decisions about radiation and chemotherapy. My then husband, not my current wonderful husband, but my then husband, was not coping well with the news. I had to deal with increasing conflict at home, as well as the surgery and treatments, and keeping up with my work as much as I could. I would never wish cancer on anyone, and certainly would have preferred not to become a member of the Cancer Club. But strangely, there were some bright lights in that dark year. I learned that more people cared about me than I realized. I was very grateful that a friend had been open about her diagnosis. It was extremely helpful to have someone to talk to who'd been through it and was now thriving. I joined a support group, and seeing healthy women many years post-diagnosis meant more to me than any doctor's statistics. I was no longer the perfect sister that everything wonderful happened to and never had any problems, and maybe partly due to that, my relationships with my brothers improved. I received a lot of love that year. But I discovered there was a downside to being open about cancer. Not everyone knew what to say, and some people blurted out totally unhelpful information. Some launched into stories of someone they knew who had died from the exact same disease. Several people assured me that I would be fine. How they knew that? Strangely, this left me feeling more alone, as I then felt that I could not share my doubts and fears. One friend strongly recommended I see the movie Wit. I don't know if you've heard of that one, but Emma Thompson submits to extensively painful treatment trials for the sake of science and gradually dies. I wish I hadn't seen it. With my experience, you would think I would know just what to say when someone I know is diagnosed with cancer. Well, I do know not to tell them stories of friends of mine who have died. And I do not recommend movies where the cancer patient dies. But like many of us, I thought it was fine to say, "Call me if there's anything I can do to help." In our meetings of the Committee on Ministry, we were studying the book, How to Say It When You Don't Know What to Say, and it contained useful guidelines of what not to say and what to say to be most helpful. When a friend's mother was recently diagnosed with cancer, I was much better prepared. I had learned that most people will not readily ask for help while still welcoming it. So using these skills I'd learned, I called and told my friend that I really did want to help. And I followed up with an email detailing when I was available and what I could do. After another follow-up phone call, I was taken up on these offers. I knew she was really stressed, trying to keep up with her demanding job while also being the primary caregiver for her mother. And it felt good to be able to do something to help. I knew it was a tiny, tiny drop in the bucket. But I also knew that for me, when I was going through it, little acts of kindness made me feel less alone, made me feel more connected. I would like to close with a reading from Kitchen Table Wisdom, by Dr. Rachel Naomi Raymond. This book of short essays was a great comfort to me when going through my treatment. And Rachel Naomi Raymond is a physician who eventually went into the specialty of counseling people struggling with cancer. One of my former clients is a psychologist and a fine athlete who ran every morning in a park near her home before going to her office. She often met a colleague there, a well-known psychiatrist. Without any formal arrangement, they had run together at about the same time for many years. After she was diagnosed with cancer, somehow her running companion was never there. My client is a strong and determined woman, and despite a difficult course of surgery and chemotherapy, she continued to run every day. After a few months of running alone, she called the psychiatrist at his office, but he never returned the call. About a year after the completion of her chemotherapy, she took a different path one morning and saw the psychiatrist running up ahead. Being 20 years younger, she overtook him easily. As they ran side by side, she told her old running companion that it had hurt her when he had not called her back. The professional community they both belonged to was small, and almost everyone had known about her cancer. Surely he had heard. The psychiatrist's answer had shocked her. He had replied, "I'm sorry. I simply did not know the right thing to say." I asked her what she would have wanted to hear. She smiled sadly. "Oh, something like, 'I've heard it's been a bad year. How are you doing?' Some simple human thing like that."
I want to thank first everybody who has shared their perspective so far. This service was my idea, and so it was great to have you share so deeply from within yourself, so thank you. It's my turn to share now. Our journey to become foster parents was a long one. I would contest that I spent my entire life becoming a foster parent. I feel it is something I was called to, and that all of my experiences led me to make the decision wholeheartedly with my spouse in June of 2009. We went through trainings on dealing with behavior issues, working with birth families, keeping children safe, but there was never any training that told us what to say to people about being foster parents. No one told us how to react to the things that people would say to us. So here are some of the most common responses that foster parents hear, and I've heard this reflected by many foster parents. So the first one is, "Oh my gosh, you are such a good person. That is so amazing of you to do that." Well, what do I say to that? The second one is, "Wow, that must be so hard. I just couldn't do that because it would be so hard to give them back." Well, yeah. That's what I signed up for. And then the third one is, "We thought about doing that." Okay. I would respond to try to normalize the conversation and make it easy for the other person. In truth, two of these responses were kind of hurtful to me, and the other just made me uncomfortable. But I also knew that all of these things people said were things that they said to support me, to show interest, or to show their love and gratitude to me. I realized pretty quickly that I can change my responses to promote a positive image of foster parents and foster care as a whole. I realized I could be a kind of spokesperson for foster care and all the families it serves. Being a good foster parent, as it is at its heart, an exercise in taking the perspective of other people. A foster parent takes the perspective of a child who has been removed from the only home he or she has known. They've been taken from the people that they are most closely bonded to, regardless of the abuse or neglect they have experienced. A foster parent takes the perspective of a parent who has lost the child or children that they love. I began to tell people about my children and how amazing and resilient they are. I began to respond to others by telling them about the birth families who love their children desperately, and in most cases have made bad life decisions or have been born into a cycle of poverty and have had few paths open to them. I began to tell people that becoming a foster parent was not my last-ditch effort to become a parent. It was my first choice. I began to tell people about the rigorous process to become certified as a foster parent and how I've never known a truly bad foster parent. I began to see that people are deeply interested in the foster care process. People want to know what happens to the children who need temporary or forever homes. They were thirsting for information, and I could give it to them. Two of the most significant experiences of my fostering took place in court, as happens. The first was when the court granted permanent custody in the case of my 5- and 8-year-old daughters. For those of you who don't know, the lingo permanent custody refers to the time when children that were previously in temporary custody awaiting reunification with their birth families are now put into permanent state custody. So you might assume that I met this decision of permanent custody for these children that I've been caring for 2 years with a great sense of relief. And I will be honest and say that that was most certainly one of the emotions I felt. However, as I sat in court with the birth parents I had seen weekly for the past 2 years and listened to this final reckoning and the effect it had on them, I felt my own body reacting just as their birth mother and their birth father were reacting. As their sobbing resounded through the courtroom, I struggled to control my own sobs. I shook as I sat listening, feeling both relief for myself and agony for them at their loss. Leaving the courtroom, I held their other mother to me as closely as I could, and I told her, "I'm sorry. I am so, so sorry." The other day in court was their adoption day. It was, of course, an outwardly joyous day where we got many congratulations. We ate pizza. We celebrated our great new beginning. But it was also a day of conflicting emotions for me. Our family was elated, and we were praised for taking responsibility. But our children were still feeling a loss. On that day, too, even as all four of us put our hands on the seal that stamped our final decree of adoption, I thought of all the loss in my children's lives and how I could never undo that. How I wish they didn't need to be adopted at all. So, what can you say when you meet a foster parent or anyone who might have a family situation that looks different from yours? If you know someone who is adopted or fostering, you could say thank you for loving the children of our world. If you meet someone that has a family situation that might be complex, don't make assumptions or ask questions unless you really know them. Treat them as you would any family and ask about their interests regardless of the age or appearances of the parental figures and the children. As we continue to be foster parents, we continue to do the hard things and the amazingly joyful things. We continue to marvel at the gift of our 3 amazing children. Every day of our lives is an exercise in taking the perspective of someone else, whether it be a foster child, a birth parent, or even the stranger that compliments my children's beautiful blue eyes and then looks up and sees that they are not my eyes. We're all just striving to be understood and understand each other. And that is what makes our world and our congregation a community. Now, I can look at that stranger, and I can look them in the eye, and I can say, yes, their birth parents have beautiful blue eyes. And I know that that stranger meant a compliment, and now they understand, and they're a part of my community. Thank you.
Our benediction today is Join Hands by Erica Hewitt. And I'd like us all to join hands with the people next to you in the pew as you are willing and able. The hand in yours belongs to a person whose heart is sometimes tender, whose skin is sometimes thin, whose eyes sometimes fill with tears, whose laughter is a beautiful sound. The hand that you hold belongs to a person who is seeking wholeness and knows that you are doing the same. As you leave this sanctuary, may your hearts remain open, may your voices stay strong, and may your hands remain outstretched.